What's up and welcome to Sweathead with Mark Pollard. Today I have Luis Miranda, who is a currently freelance strategist based in Los Angeles, but is also a music producer and DJ. And we're going to talk about all those things. Luis, I've also been studying Spanish, so I'm going to throw out some Spanish here and there just to, you know, see if I'm learning quickly enough from my reggaeton infatuation. How are you?
Thank you, Mark. It's a pleasure to be here. And you sound good in Spanish. We need to practice more.
Gracias. I'm 2 months in, dos meses. I'm going to do this just a little bit, just to annoy people. I want to nerd out on the music with you because you describe the kind of music that you make, and I want to compare notes because I was really into two kinds of music in the 1990s. One was underground hip-hop, underground rap, and the other was Doof Doof from Rotterdam, hardcore techno, GABA, happy hardcore, because Sydney had an incredible graffiti scene, an incredible hip-hop scene, and an incredible rave scene. So describe your music to us.
I make techno kind of like a hypnotic big time. There's many subgenres, but you can say techno. And it's funny that you mention hardcore, etc., because right now the speed of techno has been accelerated in the last 2 years. In fact, there is a mantra from one of the DJs, it's called Charlie Sparks, who said, "A fast pace for your face." And it's coming back. All the 90s is a trend in many different fields, in lifestyle films, also in music. And all the hardcore Thunderdome, I don't know if you're familiar with the Thunderdome compilations from back in the day, but that's like a music, electronic music is faster, stronger, for sure.
I'm going to compare notes with a particular compilation that I listened to a lot of. It was called A Nightmare in Rotterdam, 1994. It's been really interesting listening to and kind of watching the evolution of EDM in the past decade, because it's basically the same stuff from the 1990s, just a little bit more modern, maybe a bit more melodic, a little bit more poppy in some ways, a little bit more accessible. But like this album, A Nightmare in Rotterdam, is basically a vocal sample and then... And it's funny because you see people are dancing to that sort of stuff on TikTok or making fun of often very drunk people in Russia dancing to that stuff.
No, totally nail it.
Were you around that kind of hardcore Rotterdam genre in the 1990s?
Wow, I will never imagine that that will happen in Australia.
Yeah, well, we had a huge scene, a huge rave scene.
Yeah, yeah. I remember those days. Like I was still like a baby, but I started to vinyls in 92.
Because your music, I mean, it reminds me quite a bit of a lot of the stuff that I would have heard in a rave 30 years ago. It's high-paced. It's do-do-do-do. Actually, those RPMs were too slow. The titles and some of the vocal references do refer to what's going on in your head, maybe drugs, etc. Do you have a favorite drug? I'm joking. Don't answer. You thought I was being serious. Tell us a little bit about your music journey, and eventually, for the brand strategists out there, we'll connect this to things you can learn from this and apply to your brand strategy or to your brand.
I'm a DJ before being a strategist, to be honest. I connected with electronic music when I was 13 years old, and it was the first time that I went to a club, and that hooked me.
13?
Yeah, yeah, 13. Illegal, but I was with the school, to be to be honest. Because in Spain, when you are 13 to 14, you have your first trip with your class and your school teachers. And we went to the coast of Spain. And yeah, it was a controlled environment, but we went to a club. And at that time, it was acid house music. And I didn't know what it was that, but the role of the DJ, that person who was behind the DJ booth, like making the people dance, is a role that was like, oh, wow, what is this? And starting from there, I spent time just trying to figure out what that guy is doing, like observing. I make my grandmother to buy me a mixer when I turn 15.
Wow.
At that time, there was no internet. There was no ways to learn, rather than you are in the DJ, behind the DJ booth, looking and trying to understand what this guy is doing, touching buttons, etc., and then trying to replicate that at home and listening to a lot of cassette tapes to try to learn what is a good mixing. And just fast forward, I started to play in clubs and radio stations, etc. And yeah, it was really fun. And I took it very seriously until I started to work in advertising.
Yeah, I'd say like the startup costs if you wanted to be a DJ, which was pretty new when I was a teenager. The startup costs to get a couple of Technics, SP1200s, a mixer and decent speakers, and I guess you're getting an amp as well. Even if you were buying secondhand in Australia, it surely would have been $1,000 to $1,500 Australian to set up. So it was very expensive because, you know, at that age, I was probably earning $8 an hour, $7 or $8 an hour, maybe less actually.
It took me years to get to the Technics. I was 21 when I was able to buy Technics. Before that, I remember I started having one turntable without pitch, and then I was able to buy one turntable with pitch, but it was not a Technics. So I was trying just to match and bit matching in one direction only.
Right, right, right. So you're able to change the PMs, the speed of the record only on one turntable. That's interesting. What do you think attracted you to the DJing?
I don't know. It was the combination of the... It was a totally different music, and having the power of control the mood and having an impact on people at that time, making them dance. And for me, I was also a very curious person, and it was something totally new. I think the combination of all these three, the newness, the power and impact of people's behavior and control the moods and make them dance, that was kind of like the thing. Then I really enjoy the challenge of reading the crowd when you are in a club and trying to know what is the perfect track to make them keep in dancing, you know?
And so when you go to a club or you go to a party, are you someone who's in the middle of things when you're not DJing, or are you more on the wall, more observing?
To be honest, I think once you are a DJ, when you go to a club, you are in between things. Half of your brain is enjoying it, half of your brain is analyzing everything as a DJ.
But do you dance to music?
Yeah, yeah, I dance to music, yeah, yeah.
But with other people or by yourself?
Both. Both.
I'm just testing a cliche that some DJs are socially awkward and prefer to be watchers and observers, which is a lot of the guys that I used to know.
To be honest, I was a shy person, and for me, DJ also helped me to overcome that. Not to overcome, but to create my own space. I was never a guy who went to the girls and trying to pick up girls. I just tried to dance by myself, and I was very shy. So DJing and being that position helps me to flourish in that environment.
See, that's why I asked, were you dancing, and were you dancing by yourself or with other people? Don't worry, I've been around. Tell me a little bit about the shift into production. When did you start producing? How old were you?
I shifted to production 7 years ago, surprisingly, because when I started to work in advertising, I didn't have time to be a DJ and also learning music production. So 7 years ago, I was starting to be old. I don't want to say my age, but I have a voice in my shoulder asking me, hey, what are you doing with your life? You always wanted to do music, to make music. And I started to learn by myself. I joined some online courses. I spoke to different friends who are music producers. So I tried to learn from as much different sources as possible. And that was 7 years ago. Has taken a lot of time, because I think music production takes even more time than learn how to DJ. And it's a non-stop learning. There are always new plugins, new technologies, new hardware, etc. And you always are trying to push the boundaries and trying to find new ways to make music as you want.
Yeah, I think one of the amazing things about now, let's call it the past decade, it's probably a little bit more. If you want to learn something, if you want to get good at something, everything is there and a lot of it's available for free in a way that it really wasn't in the 1980s, 1990s, and obviously before. I think I bought Cubase, or I had like a burnt copy of it, because it was probably $500 back then and couldn't afford it. Probably had a $200 computer. But it was just so much more work to try to make anything happen, and backing up things on zip drives or whatever the thing you were using back then, and computers crashing, the internet breaking, access breaking, and things like that. But now there's just so much stuff available. What software do you use?
I use Ableton.
So I've been working with them.
Oh, nice.
And, you know, I've committed to studying Spanish an hour or two a day, and I'm 60 days into that. And they're like, hey, do you want a license? Because you keep talking about this. And I do, but I'm so intimidated about learning something from almost from scratch right now. I just don't know if I could compete with the Bad Bunnies and Rao Alejandros and Rosalitas and Carol G's of the world. Maybe one day I'll make a beat for them when I'm like 55 years old and I'll get on one of their albums.
I encourage you to play with it because it's very intuitive, it's very easy. And as you said, nowadays you have so much content accessible for free to how to learn. And even if you want to focus on a specific genre, there's content for that genre. So I'll share later some links to you.
Now, I didn't mention much of your background. I just kind of wanted to jump into the techno talk because I was excited. But, you know, you've been director of brand marketing at Kajabi. You've worked at AKQA, Deutsch. Some of these are freelance. Some of them are full-time roles. But you're also co-founder of the APG in Spain. Tell us a little bit about that.
That was interesting because there was a time when I was an account executive that wanted to be a planner. I was like a very single-minded. I wanted to be a planner. And I found one way to do it was to try to bring the account planning group from London to Spain and start to build a community. It was a funny paradox because I found the account planning group with another account person. So two account person founding the account planning group in Spain. And yeah, it was great. We started with around like 30 planners. Has been growing up since then. For me, it was a way to reinforce my credibility that I want to be a planner, that I was interested in that, and help the planning community in Spain.
I mean, so for those of you who are listening to this and don't know, the Account Planning Group is kind of the home of planning in the UK. There are, what would you call them, arms of the APG, although they're often independent in a bunch of countries around the world. I was on the committee as a kid in Australia, like I think I was 29 or 30. Lots of case studies, so worth joining or maybe even joining an APG from a different country if you want to access some of the case studies for often the Creative Strategy Awards, training opportunities, all kinds of stuff. It was good for me. And I understand what you're saying about starting that to sort of create a center of gravity around you, but also around planning in Spain. I know that you're in the US right now, but how would you describe the past decade or two of planning in Spain? Is it mature there? Are there many planners there? What's it like?
Yeah, I mean, I'm in contact with a lot of people in Spain and also with the people who currently run the account planning group. And I think it's growing really well. It's been very healthy. They are very active. Also, in collaborating with, there's the El CDC is the creative club, and also the Association of Advertisers. So they are doing things together with two key stakeholders of the advertising, which is the clients and the creatives as well. So that's from an organizational point of view. In terms of the role, I think like in Spain has been a great growth and it's more mature than ever. There's room to grow for sure, but also it's very diverse. I know that Clan Planning Group has a very diverse profile that have inside brand planners, communication planners, people from consultancies, media agencies, etc., etc. So also that's a very healthy approach, having inclusivity, even clients who are interested in the strategy as well.
Just a quick shout out, because I am nerding out on the Spanish language and the origins of it. For those of you who are listening who are interested in words and history, watch some videos on YouTube about Alfonso el Sabio. He was the king of Spain who formalized, well, the Spanish language as we know it now. Is that correct?
Yeah, Alfonso X el Sabio, yeah.
Yeah, super interesting, because there's obviously lots of little enclaves of people, and then you had North Africans, and everyone kind of was moving around that peninsula. And then Alfonso, I think his dad was like a big guy. His dad was a big guy. He was pretty good at what he did. And then Alfonso's like, how am I going to be a big guy? And he ended up sort of, I guess, formalizing Spanish. It's so interesting.
Yeah, there was a time that Alfonso decided to unify languages, because to be honest, the Peninsula Iberica, it was a melting pot of different type of people, different type of religions as well. If you go to Toledo in Spain, there is a Jew, Muslim, Christian neighborhoods all together. And that's the reason, because also in Spain for almost 1,000 years, half of Spain was Muslim and it was Arab origin, you know? So it's really fascinating. I mean, I know this is for another podcast, but yeah, the story of Spain is amazing.
Dude, I love it. I love it. Because I've been traveling a lot. And, you know, obviously the Basque people and their language, people don't necessarily know where it's from. Although I was out in Georgia last year. And so some of the videos are suggesting there might be a connection between Basque and the people in Georgia and maybe the steppe plains, etc. It's just amazing. It blows me away. If I'm a little bit down and I watch those videos, like a video like that about the history of the Basque people or the Spanish language, I'm like, oh my God. It just lifts me. It lifts me. It fills me with awe, AWE. I love it. Let's connect the techno-culture discussion, which we shot over because I'm infatuated with Spanish right now, and see how we can link that to what people can learn about our brand endurance. Because I know that you've done a talk about this particular topic. So working title, 5 things for strategists to learn from techno-culture for brand endurance. Let's go through the 5 that you've got there.
Yeah, the first one is kind of like related on how techno was born, you know, like it was in Detroit. I think the 3 official fathers of techno are Juan Atkins, Kevin Swanderson, and Derrick May. And the context of how it was born, it was a social context of depression in Detroit after all the automotive industry left the city. And these guys starting to have different ways to escape of that reality. It was focusing on future experimentation, technology, because, you know, one of the things that Detroit was famous for is like all the technology, high technology that the automotive companies brought to the table. So I think the first point is the idea of future-minded, urgent motivations. And it's a dichotomy that we also seen in the advertising industry, because for brands to be successful, I think right now we are living in the short term too much. And we also need to think about the future of the brand and what the future customers are and build that long-term at the same time. So for me, that characteristic of techno, that having that future-minded approach, but also be centered on the urgent motivations of today, I think is really an interesting point that relates to the brand building nowadays.
Keep one eye on history and one eye on the foundations and one eye on the things that are popping up that are new.
Absolutely. And, you know, like experiment and explore, because, you know, like this future techno was about technology and it was about trying to think what's coming or trying to experiment with the future minded ahead. So I think explorability and experimentation is also areas that any brand needs to do if they want to endure.
Smart person. Hey, pull your mind out of those timesheets for a second and take a look at the Sweathead website. We have 3 membership levels, Starter Mode, Flight Mode, and Beast Mode. They give you access to a variety of strategy masterclasses, conferences, accelerators, and online learning, some of which has been known to make people cry because they like it, they like it, they feel seen. Make the most of your mind this year or any year and visit www.sweathead.com today. Now back to the interview. We all know deep down that if we're pitching or even if we're just put onto a client that's been in an agency, if we're in an agency with that client, that the first thing we often want to do is just throw out what's been done and start fresh, because we're addicted to novelty. That's openness is one of the big 5 personality traits. So openness is about seeking out variety, novelty, experiences, etc. And there's plenty of research. It comes from various places. I think System One talks about this quite a lot over in the UK, about how the people who get sick of advertising the fastest are the people who make it. And probably by the time that you're sick of it, if you work in an agency making advertising, it's probably just when it's starting to register with the audience.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right. Point number 2.
Point number 2, it was related to one of the maybe most trendy topics nowadays, which is the idea of the communities, fandoms, and finding your future fans as well. So I think techno is always embracing the different subcultures. Nowadays, for example, if you are in techno, it's embracing the fetish core culture, you know, all the people also that are into sex forward mindsets, gender fluid, etc., which is quite interesting if you are in the electronic music, because in the past, house music has the role of attracting LGBTQ communities. And now techno, because has been a collision between different subcultures, like I said, the sex forward and now clubs, like a famous clubs, German clubs like Berghain, Kit Kat, who are like a mock sex forward, have an impact on in the clothing. Like right now, you go to a techno party and all the kids are dressing up with leather, with sunglasses, with like a, it's a mix of gothic industrial vibe. And I was in Spain in October in Zara, and I was looking at, oh, fuck, now Zara has leather outfits because they understand this trend right now. So I think like being aware of all these communities and embrace those communities and empower those communities is something that techno is doing quite well. And I think like a brand needs to find a way to do it in authentic ways.
Yeah, as soon as you mentioned Fetish Core, I was going to ask you about Berlin and that club. I was going to call it Berghaus, but it's Berghains, is it?
Yeah.
I don't go to those kinds of places. But, you know, maybe I would just to observe and to do some research.
To be honest, now you don't have to go to those places because also part of that vibe is becoming more mainstream in the techno scene, especially in the rave scene. Because there's also a distinction between a club, party in a club, or party in a rave or underground warehouse. To be honest, that was one of the reasons because VPNs has been accelerated after the pandemic. One of the reasons was because, yes, people with the pandemic, once the pandemic finished, they want to extra party and release themselves and party harder. But other things like because of the pandemic, a lot of the clubs shut down. And the role of some clubbing also is to control the speed, the VPNs. Because, you know, if you accelerate the VPNs a lot, you are going to exclude other audience, which at the end is what has more money to spend, you know. And right now, after the pandemics, the number of warehouse parties and rapes has increased, and there is no much control on the VPN. So VPNs go faster, people can dress up without t-shirts. So there's much more freedom to be yourself and to enjoy and be wild.
Right. But you're saying that the older people can't keep up.
It's true, you know. And if you start a party and the music is 150, 160 BPMs, I mean, older people are going to turn off.
That's true. When the treadmill, you know, when my heartbeat reaches about 150, 160, I'm sweating quite a lot. But, you know, back in the day, it would have been 180, 190. This rings true. Okay, third point.
Third point, it's what I call the underground attitude. Techno is always coming from the underground. In fact, there was a group that was created in 1989 called Underground Resistance. And it was like a son of the pioneers also of techno with Matt Mike Banks, Jeff Mills, Robert Hood. And they have a rebellious attitude and going against convention and trying to claim the role of techno in the electronic music in the US because there was a big difference. Techno was very successful, quite mainstream in Europe, but not in the US. So these guys were trying from the underground to claim that battle. And I think that mindset and attitude at going against the convention is something that you need as a brand. And I'm not saying that all the brands has to be like a Liquid Death, but you need to find your underground side on what is your underground element or your underground essence and trying to foster that. Because if you want to endurance in that business, you need that.
Yeah, I follow that because I think most brands need to find some kind of edge, which could be absurdism or something that doesn't quite belong there, because otherwise people won't pay attention to them. And I'm talking largely about the communication or design of the brand. I guess underground is an interesting way to think about that too. Are you saying like a big bank? How could they be a bit underground?
You still need to be mainstream. You still need to reach to a lot of people, but you need to find your edge, your unconventional way, you know. Like, for example, when I was comparing Oatly and Liquid Death, there are totally different ways for me behave with an underground attitude, you know, but still both are reaching to a lot of people. So in this case, underground doesn't mean that you are going to reduce your market and just reach to a small group of people.
Yeah, it's funny. How does that work in the US though? Like, again, if we think about banking, Australia's got a couple of maybe four or five really good, strong banks that have survived all the downturns in very strong ways. And one of them did a campaign for the Mardi Gras involving gay TMs instead of ATMs. Mainstream bank, gay TM was kind of the main idea that they built around. I couldn't see anything like that happening in the US with a mainstream bank. I don't know how the mainstream banks here could ever communicate in a way that's actually interesting. How does this point translate specifically to US conservative businesses? Can it? Does it?
I think that some brands are doing it, but I think it's maybe selling because the US, they have awareness of the idea of being the challenger, right? Like you can be the challengers without have to be the underdog, you know? I don't know which brands right now are having that mentality center stage of their strategy. Executionally, there are different brands that are doing different things in that sense, but really brands like, I don't know, like a Tony Chocolonely, I think is a brand that is doing different things in their own way, or like, as I say, Liquid Dead, or I don't know. But it's true that the US probably is more risk averse towards being like a more bold, you know?
I feel like quote-unquote edgy work, because that's probably not the best title or label for it. It mostly comes out of a handful of places. Right now, it's Mischief, Mojo Supermarket over in the UK, yeah. Uncommon, Lucky Generals. The kind of work that they all do is way more mainstream in a few other markets like New Zealand and Australia and the UK and probably Sweden and Brazil and places like that. But the US is definitely more conservative.
And also, I think like it not necessarily has to be super edgy, but as you teach in Sweatheads, it's like a find an interesting way to show something that is familiar and familiar, or find something unfamiliar that has not been used. So I think like Uncommon is great to maybe they don't do something super disruptive in an executional way, but the strategy that leads to that has a twist, you know?
I wouldn't even use the word edgy to describe some of my favorite stuff from other countries. It's just, I would call it good. Like right now, there's a campaign out of Australia for lamb. There's a day called Australia Day. I've been out of the country for 12 years, so I think there's different names of that particular day. I'm not sure where the zeitgeist is right now. Invasion Day is an alternate name because it sort of celebrates the colonization of Australia, which has obviously a lot of different kinds of meanings and impacts on different people. But lamb is always promoted around Australia Day on January 26th. I don't know if you've seen the ad, but it's all about the different generations and there being generation gaps. But the one thing that they can come around is lamb. But it's written in a really hilarious way. Australia, I do feel a lot of our advertising is still stuck in the 1970s, but it's cute. I love it. And that's an exceptional campaign, very well written and very well made. I wouldn't even say it had edge. I just think that's just good advertising. But if that was done in the US, I'd be like, whoa, that's edgy. So who have we become? What are we doing here? That's my question. Point number four.
It's about something that has been raising in the marketing world, but it's also, I tackle that from a music and techno point of view, which is the idea of back-to-back. DJ sets, there's a lot of DJs that play together, and it's called back-to-back. For me, that took me to think about the idea of collaboration and partnerships. And I think we have seen a trend of a lot of brands trying to deliver creative partnerships with other brands, with celebrities, even with consumers, co-create as well. So I think like there is like a new wave of that. And when it comes to music, for me, a great example of that is like, you know, Grimes give access to their voice. Because, you know, right now there's so much technology that anyone is able to copy your voice. So she was smart ahead and said, well, everyone is going to do it anyways. So I'm going to release my voice in this official way. And everyone who uses it, I'm going to put a smart contract behind it. And I'm going to get a percentage of that royalty. So that's interesting new ways to collaborate that probably influenced by the mechanisms of Web3 and blockchain, etc. They can offer like a new landscape of possibilities for brands in the future as well.
Here's what I have so far, being future-minded, but keeping the origins of the brand in place, trying to understand communities, fandoms, and play with them in interesting ways, having some kind of underground attitude, and then this one back-to-back, partnerships with other brands, right? So we're at five. What have you got as fifth?
Yeah. So as fifth is what I call the power of the loop. And it's the idea that techno by itself is a very loopy music. We repeat a lot of patterns and samples, and people might think for some people it's boring music and it's all the time the same, right? And I think this idea of repeating and repurposing is very interesting in a world where we just recent research show that advertising doesn't wear out as much as we think for people. Maybe for the people who make the ads, it's wear out faster. But to be honest, for consumers, it's not as fast. So I think like there is an opportunity for kind of like a circular economy of content and trying to repurpose content that works and also extend the big ideas or the platform ideas. Because to be honest, I think like I see less big ideas lately than in the past. And there's opportunities to extend what it works and doing spin-offs. And I don't know, the possibilities are multiple.
Why do you think there's been a trend away from big ideas?
I think like the short-term fever is killing big ideas and long-term platforms, you know, and changing CMOs so fast doesn't help to have this cathedral thinking that is necessary, that goes beyond a person, you know, and in favor of the brand. I think that's one porqué. Probably there are more.
I'll give you another one and then we'll go back to back and let's see if we can get a few more. I think and this is not a diss, the ascendancy of the product marketer who has a lot of features and is very product focused and not so much user or consumer focused, even if they're involved with doing research about people and how they use things. The briefs they usually write are just lists of features, and then they are seen as being more important than anyone doing creative work in an in-house agency or in an external agency. And they really often, in the US at least, especially on the West Coast, just want their features messaged. That's what I've seen a lot of. I see a lot of briefs from big, big, big famous companies. And it's like, oof, gosh, why are there 10 pages of bullet points? That's not a very useful brief. Back to back, why else do you think this trend has happened?
I think clients are very focused on the shiny trends and the social trends. And they have lost a bit of what is the strategy a lot of times and what do you stand for and what is your direction? You know, I think nowadays is like your trajectory is super important. Maybe you don't know what is the destination, but having a trajectory and a direction is important. Companies are jumping into what is the shiny latest trend. Even it's not a trend. They call it trend, but it's just a social trend. I think right now, strategy is your words. And I think like in the past, everyone bastardized the use of the word inside strategy. And now trends, that is social media trends are a small short life or short span and reflections on different trends. But I think that's another area.
Chasing trends, working out your hashtags, trying to quote unquote go viral, that's still out there. We would have made fun of that stuff 10 years ago. The final one that I'll throw down, I think, is maybe more difficult to acknowledge in public for some people, but I just think there's a complete lack or a big lack of conceptual and strategic training. So, you know, I've seen reports about the size of the US advertising industry, and apparently it's bigger than ever or close to being bigger than ever, which I don't quite understand because I know a lot of people who are desperate for work, who are trying to freelance, who've been out of work for a very long time. I don't know the makeup of these jobs, but apparently the quote unquote advertising industry in the US is very large right now. Again, surprising, but a lot of people are not trained. It's about project plans and operations and logistics and data, but the conceptual thinking is either, it's just not common. A lot of people don't know how to do it. They don't allow time for it. So I think that's a massive issue that people don't really understand because they're often in environments where it has never existed.
I am starting to see agencies starting to going back to recreate like training programs and things. I think like last year, I started to see a couple of big agencies revamping the training programs because of, you are totally right. Like I think younger generations don't have a reference and they don't have also the time from senior people in the agencies and they are I think also there are other factors that are influencing like the juniorization and the need for the agencies to attract talent and give titles to young people that maybe they are not ready for taking the responsibilities. And you know, I think that like creates a loop that is not healthy because people are moving forward in their careers without the foundations and without proper training. Yes, they have capabilities to manage a project, to deal with clients because they are thrown into the water and to the ocean and they have to do it. But I think like there's a lack of training that don't favor great strategic thinking.
Yeah, and then throw into that, especially when time's tough and middle management gets cut, and strategists rarely have much middle management at all. But often there's an increasing gap between the young and the older or more seasoned people. There's definitely research from the 4As about the aging. Basically, there's a lot of new people in the industry, but also there's this middle layer missing that could be mentoring. So you kind of get this lack of training, maybe a lack of on-the-job mentoring, and that all gets compounded by, I think, a lot of people are worried about what's coming with AI and generally speaking with the economy, although there's also some optimism. And so people can become a little bit more self-focused or individualistic. So those three things can come together and mean that there's just not as much development as there could be, which I find sad. Two final questions for you. Why did you leave Spain?
I had an opportunity to live in Singapore and work in Singapore at some point of my career. It was temporary. It was 6 months and I love it, but I had to return to Spain. That changed my mind. You know, that blew up my mind, that experience. And since there, I tried to leave Spain again for a longer period because I think discover new cultures and having experience of living in another country, it's so enrich your life as a person, but also as a strategist. And trying to understand different audiences and living in another country, and it's a great experience.
Final question. What do you miss about the work culture, like advertising and planning in Spain?
I miss the care of the craft and the qualitative aspect. I think in Europe and also including in Spain, people care more about the work, and qualitative research is much more important, really understanding what's the problem and what's the tension. And I don't know, I feel that the US is much more driven by quant and numbers. And sometimes I feel like a lack of that emotion that you can see in other parts of the world.
Yeah, I feel I see that in the school culture, just watching my kids go through high school. It's like a meat grinder, all these sort of tests and things. But I don't think it's fair to say that the education system and therefore the work culture can feel a bit soulless in the US. But my personal experience is that it felt soulless, like a lot of corporate HR, a lot of corporate America materialism. And I'm like, I want to do good work. I want to get paid well. Yeah. And I want to grow a good team and be competitive and win pitches, but I also want to do really good work. And I found that an unusual thing to think and then say out loud. And it still confuses me.
I think one of the problems in the US is like a, maybe don't foster too much creative thinking. To be honest.
Well, entonces, Luis Miranda, muchas gracias para hablar conmigo. Did I say that right?
Yeah, muchas gracias por hablar conmigo.
I knew it. Por hablar conmigo. I got to get a good Spanish accent soon. My goal is to do a short talk in Spanish at some point.
Take some time, you know, you practice more and you are going to get it.
All right, man. If people want to find you on the internet, where are you most busy?
I'm in LinkedIn. Also, people can find me in Spotify if they want to listen to my music, or in SoundCloud, or maybe in a club close to where you live.
I love it. I love it. Or in Berlin sometime. Well, Luis, I appreciate you talking with me today. I love nerding out about that techno world because it's a rare conversation for me these days. Best wishes with the music, the production, the DJing, and also with the strategy career.
Thank you very much, Mark. It was a pleasure.
Peace. Thank you for listening to this episode of Sweathead. If you enjoyed it, please share it with a friend, subscribe to our newsletter, find us on Instagram or LinkedIn at Sweathead. And if you're interested in finding out about our strategy memberships, company training, or books, visit sweathead.com. Whoop, whoop.